My guest today is one of the world's most productive and highly cited ecologists. If I was Dame Edna, I'd say this would be my hello possum moment. David Lindemeyer is Professor of Ecology and Conservation Biology at the Australian National University. He's a Eureka Prize winner and also a finalist in the Prime Minister's Environmentalist of the Year Award for 2013. Now, just a few stats for David. They include having published over 490 peer-reviewed scientific papers, 36 books, as well as undertaking the longest study recorded on the mountain ash forest in the Central Highlands in Victoria, a study David has now been involved with for over 30 years. And this, of course, includes the monitoring of Leadbeater's possum. If you dig down into his CV, you'll find that he once considered being a professional footballer, the round ball kind. He played in the National League in the late 70s, but it seems professional football's loss was to be junior soccer's gain, as David has been a fine junior soccer coach for many years. David Lindemeyer is also passionate about his role as a mentor and the role we play, the community, in monitoring our environment. He counts the work of over 8,500 volunteers as crucial to his work. Now, it's terrific to be having this longer chat today. And speaking of mentoring, you're just back from the forest, aren't you?
That's correct. We just had a week in the wet forest of Victoria, and we had 24 people from our group. All up, we have 37 scientists now in our group, but 24 of those came with us to work in the forest, and it was a wonderful time. Lots of discussion of ideas, lots of field work, of course, that's mandatory. Just a fantastic opportunity to work through what students are doing and then think about new opportunities, career trajectories, all those kinds of things.
How important is that role for you, and who did that for you?
I had some wonderful mentors in my time. Professor Henry Nix was formerly the director of the Centre for Resource and Environmental Studies, which has now become the Fenner School at the Australian National University. And also, I've worked for a long time with a wonderful man called Ross Cunningham, a statistician. And for 40 years, that man set aside his own PhD work and did the statistics and mentoring for hundreds and hundreds of PhD students. An extraordinary man. And he helped me with my PhD, so I thought that it was really important to give back to the system from where I came from.
So that's really an important part of your role.
I actually think it's the most important role, to be able to train the next cohorts, generations of young scientists to come through to understand the environment, to understand conservation, to understand trade-offs, economic and other sorts of things to do with how we manage this amazing country.
Mm. Interestingly, I noticed a report coming out of the Perth newsroom about Professor David Goodall, who turns 100 next month. He's an ecologist and botanist. He goes to work 5 days a week at Edith Cowan University. He officially retired 30 years ago, but he says it's mentoring PhD students that's really important to him.
Oh, wow. That's, 46 and a half years to go. That's amazing, Alex. But I think it is wonderful having really bright young PhD students and postdoctoral researchers around to help them develop their careers, because really that's the future of the country and the future of science, the future of managing our environment. And I think the wonderful thing in my group is that most of the vast majority of people coming through are much, much better than I am. And that's really what it's all about. You want people to be progressing and doing things better than what you're able to do.
To go back, David, back even before football, tell us about a young kid sitting in a car on epic car journeys, and we've all been there in this big, big, wide land, haven't we?
Oh, we used to do these extraordinary drives. My parents came from central Queensland. My mother's from Mount Morgan. My father's parents are around Harvey Bay, Point Vernon area. And the amazing thing was that we used to make these epic car trips from Melbourne, where we lived, all the way to central Queensland. And this was in the days before car radios that worked, before DVD players in cars, before CDs. You know, and after you've played interminable numbers of I Spy games, I had to do something else. And I found myself looking out the window at landscapes, thinking about these environments and what animals are in them and what it might be like to live and work in these kinds of places. And I'm quite sure that that's where my sort of fondness for Australian landscape started.
So instead of "Are we there yet?" it was "What bird is that?"
Not quite. I'm sure there was thousands of "Are we there yet? Do we have to do this?" kind of stuff. You know, every parent goes through that. But more just thinking about how you're going to entertain yourself and learn the spirit of endurance, which becomes very important later on in my own scientific career and that of my students as well.
But do you remember the questions that went round your head as a kid in that car?
I certainly do from my mid-teens. For example, when we drove to Adelaide and also to northwestern Victoria into the Wimmera, I used to look at these landscapes, amazing places, but often they'd just be the residual lines of trees around gully lines and creeks and streams. And I used to think, well, where are all the trees and why are the trees just in lines? And what might have this looked like before? We used to see countless numbers of foxes squashed on the road. I used to think about what would Australia have been like without some of these things that really shouldn't be here. And so I do remember quite a lot some of those kinds of thinking about what we were seeing as we were driving along.
It's really interesting. I think I saw Dave Hughes, very farts, funny guy, comedian, and I think he was making a trip to Adelaide and he commented and he said, there's all these signs as I'm going along going, protect the hollow trees. What's that about?
Well, I think what we've started to realise increasingly is that not only are the really big trees important in forests, but they're also important in agricultural areas. Paddock trees are really legacies of the time that white settlement occurred in Australia. And they're the things that we're losing very quickly from these environments. And one of the big drivers of that is the firewood industry, which is huge in Australia. And that really does have a big effect on what our landscapes look like. Now, having said that, one of the things that's been amazing in the 35 to 40 years since we made those epic car drives is that we can see a huge amount more native vegetation cover on farms throughout these environments. And it's a wonderful, positive story, really. What's happening is that farms...
So it's not all doom and gloom.
It's not all doom and gloom by any stretch of the imagination. We've seen fantastic things done by literally hundreds and hundreds of farmers that we work with between central Victoria right through to Gundawindi in Queensland. A lot of planting work, a lot of remnant protection, and some really positive outcomes. And our science shows it's been very, very positive for biodiversity.
And that's a real credit to farmers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We see farmers doing amazing things like tackling secondary salinity, tackling land erosion, doing plantings for biodiversity, better paddock management, and they're really positive stories. And the great thing is that we've been able to monitor that for the last 20 years with good scientific monitoring and see very positive results for birds of conservation concern, many species of reptiles, many species of possums and gliders, and farm productivity itself.
Can you think of feedback from a farmer that's really touched you?
Oh, many times farmers have said to us, well, why should our plantings only be two trees wide? You know, where's the evidence? And we would say, well, we've now been looking at this for 7 or 8 years, and we can see that if we do it this way, we get these positive benefits. And if we do it the other way with just very narrow strips of plantings, we don't really get very far. And then later, because it takes farmers quite some time to get used to this science process, but also to build trust, they'll say, what should we do next? What should we do next? We've done the plantings between our paddocks. We've fenced off our streamline areas. What else should we do? And so that's that evolution of thinking from farmers who are incredibly practical people with the science of actually documenting what's effective and what's not and how we might change it.
Now, you say your dad became a bird nut and this influenced you and this flowed over to you. Now, you are fluent in bird and we're going to get to that, David Lindemeyer. Can I just get you to put your headphones on because this is another language I want you to translate for me.
Messi with a chance. Messi! Beautifully hit.
And now Barcelona turning the spigot full. Sanchez back post and there's two. It's Messi again. One step closer to Cesar. Messi. Slots it home like that. Like a knife through butter. Messi with 20. Barcelona with 3.
Translate that for me, David Lindemeyer.
Alex, this sounds like my son watching YouTube clips of Barcelona's best 100 goals or
whatever.
They're
pretty compelling. I've watched a few.
That's right. The only thing we didn't hear was the sort of classic sort of Mexican and sort of Spanish commentator going, gol, 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 that kind of thing. And yes, it's part of my passion in life is football and particularly watching my kids play.
But let's take us back, because at one stage in your life, you professional football was there for you.
Yes, it's true. I'm disguised as a much older man now, Alex. But in my teen years, I played a lot of soccer, perhaps too much. And in part it came from when we left Victoria and came to Canberra. And my parents were very concerned about potential injuries in sort of more brutal versions of football. And they wanted me to play either hockey or soccer. And so I elected to play soccer. And in many ways it was a good thing, because not many other kids played. So you didn't really have to be that good to be good at soccer. And so from under 10s through to under 19s, that was kind of my life. And there were some wonderful coaches here in Canberra. There's a marvellous man named Jimmy Hayes. And there's actually a pavilion named after him here in Canberra. And he dedicated so much of his life to training young kids. And he was a brilliant man. He was competitive, but it was more about actually participating and being involved in the game. And I think that's really a wonderful psyche.
You actually played in the Netherlands.
Yes, I was in the National League. It was then called the Philips Soccer League. I'm not sure I'm supposed to even mention those names, but they were the sponsor in the early days. It was actually the first National League of any sport. And as a sponsor of that league, they also had a fellowship to a place called Eindhoven, which is right on the border with Belgium, so the southern part of the Netherlands. And I went to play there with a huge Dutch team called PSV. And the P in PSV actually stands for Philips, so you can see the link there. And that was quite a remarkable time, because the Netherlands were a huge force in international football at that stage and had played World Cup finals in 1974 and 1978.
So this was big.
It was huge, and it was quite an eye-opener to see how good those players were and how not so good I was.
Was that a blow? Because you say you realised you weren't going to cut it as a professional footballer. Was that a blow?
Not really, Alex, because one of the things that really happened in my life then was that I was exposed to a lot of other amazing things in terms of cultures of other countries and landscapes and scenery from other countries. And that sort of really melded with where my mindset was going at that stage. And in many ways, it was great to be able to see that and just look at the level of professionalism and the level of football culture that's woven throughout Dutch culture, as it is in many other countries, Brazil, elsewhere. But I think it also opened my eyes to how many other amazing things there were to do on the planet and sort of my life.
So instead of putting your head down and thinking that's part of you, put your head up.
Yes. Yeah. And it really did open my eyes to other parts of the world and other opportunities and the realization that there are other things that I could do and be involved in that. And the reality is, in my school life, football was very time consuming, and unlike amazing sports stars like Ryan Carter, for example, grew up here in Canberra. That guy is amazing in the sense that he not only topped his year at school, but he was also an elite sports person. I wasn't able to do that. My brain space to include both very high school performance and very high sporting performance just wasn't capable of doing that.
You talked about mentoring, and you continue to do this because you've been a junior soccer coach for many years, so that's really important to you. You've got a son and a daughter who are very fine players.
Yes, I love watching them play, and I've had to learn how to be a more civilised human being from the sideline than I might have otherwise have been. And I try not to be one of those over-the-top soccer dads, and I know that at various stages I have been and then had to sit down and think, no, this is not where it's at.
But you never got to the level of abusing the ref?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, now my son is a referee, and I go to his refereeing games all the time, and lots of the other parents are shouting and screaming, and then they turn to me and say, which side are you on? And my response is always, the man in black. And that seems to have
that's where we should all be.
That's right. And that seems to have a bit of a sobering, I suppose, a sobering time for people to look and, you know, they think about it for at least 2 minutes before they go back to what they're like anyway.
So, as you said, you put your head up and you looked around the world. And tell me, when you came home, I think you put your head underwater, didn't you? Didn't you, marine biology?
Yes, I did. I got very interested in marine biology. And I suppose one of the things that happened, I'd played an enormous amount of team sport, not only football, but a lot of cricket as well. And team sports, I think, are fantastic for children and people growing up, because it teaches you how to lose and it teaches you how to win with grace, hopefully. And it teaches a lot of other things about how to be involved with a team of people. But I hadn't done much in the way of outdoor sports, and I became really interested in cross-country skiing and also scuba diving. And the scuba diving took me into the whole area of marine science. And so from there, I trained in Canberra, but then went to Queensland and studied at James Cook University for a couple of years and worked for an extraordinary man called Charlie Verrin. And he described all of the corals on the Great Barrier Reef and many of the corals in northwestern Western Australia. And my job working with Charlie was to swim behind him, this is all on scuba, with a laundry basket, and he would chip off corals and throw them over his shoulder into this laundry basket. And so I'd have to swim behind this amazing man who seemed like he had gills. He would just go on forever and ever underwater, and I'd have this massive sort of basket full of corals. And that was an extraordinary time and an extraordinary man. And I think he's still alive and still doing amazing science and mentoring people, which I think
well,
is
wonderful. Well, he is, because Ian McCallman, in his wonderful book called The Reef, on the Great Barrier Reef, quotes him right at the end in terms of his hopes for the reef and its survival.
Yeah, extraordinary man. Amazing to work for. And we saw a lot of Australia underwater.
But you came out of the water.
Well, a good friend of my father's at this stage and my mother's was another extraordinary man, Henry Nix, who now lives in southeast Queensland. He was the professor and director of the Centre for Resource and Environmental Studies for many years, arguably its best director. And Henry had a really deep love of the land. He was involved in these extraordinary surveys of Northern Australia in the 1950s and 60s, and they really understood how little of Australia, for example, is appropriate to be converted to intensive agriculture. So, you know, there's a really important, there was a whole division of CSIRO that was designed to look at land capability, and Henry was one of those. Then he came to the ANU, and he really resurrected the Centre for Resource and Environmental Studies. And as part of that, he really encouraged me to become involved in surveys of wildlife and the environment and looking at all sorts of places and beginning to think about those kinds of things. So together with Ross Cunningham, my statistician mentor, those two people had a massive effect on my subsequent career in ecology.
Professor David Lindemeyer is my guest. This is Conversations. Alex Sloan sitting in for Richard Feidler. You've been studying the mountain ash forests of the Central Highlands in Victoria for over 30 years. How did you first get there?
I first began working for a scientist called Dr Andrew Smith, who was at the University of New England, and he'd done the first PhD on Leadbeater's possum. And he was funded by the World Wildlife Fund, or Worldwide Fund for Nature, as it's now called, to look at the habitat requirements of Leadbeater's possum. So this was in mid-1983, and I was the technical assistant for that project. And I've never moved on, Alex. I'm still working there 31 years later.
And it's Leadbeater's possum, isn't it? Because some people argue, oh, no, it's Leadbeater's, but it's Leadbeater's possum.
It's Leadbeater's possum, and it's named after John Leadbeater, who was the taxidermist at the National Museum of Victoria. And I suppose you could say he's the first man that stuffed Leadbeater's possum. So Leadbeater's possum was described from four or five specimens, actually a long way south of Melbourne. And so he set up the specimens, recognised it was a new species. And those specimens are still around. And that was the animal's name.
Tell me about it. I noticed in some of the literature it's sometimes called the fairy possum.
Yes, there was an advocate for conservation very early, a man called Peter Rawlinson, who's now unfortunately passed away. But he named the animal in one article the fairy possum. And I was always intrigued by this because, having worked with Leadbeater's possum in the field, this is This is not a shy, retiring creature by any stretch of the imagination. So it's not a big animal. It's only about 160 grams. So you can get a couple of these in a tub of margarine, basically. But it's a very aggressive creature. It's colonial, and it's run by a very dominant matriarchal system. And as soon as a member of the colony gets into trouble, that animal starts calling, and there are possums that come everywhere to beat up the owl or beat up the ecologist that's working with the animal. And
I have been bitten, literally.
And at times we mimic the call when we're in the forest, and animals come from everywhere, and you can hear them, and they're chattering and challenging, and they'll come in and they'll actually bite you.
Can you do the call?
It's sort of that kind of call, and it sounds a bit nondescript, but that's enough to send Leadbeater's possum into apoplexy when you're out in the forest. So the name fairy possum doesn't really sort of fit with this incredible animal. You know, it's thought to have been extinct, and then it's come back. It's been a symbol of conflict in forests for over 40 years. It's incredibly aggressive to defend its territory. You know, the females will actually, dominant female will actually take pretty severe steps to boot out her daughters once they've reached the sort of adolescent stage. So fairy possum doesn't kind of work for me, Alex.
I suppose, David Lindemann, people go, over 30 years studying a possum, what's the point of that?
Well, what actually happened was that, yes, we started working with Leadbeater's possum, but we very quickly realised that we needed to know what the other species of possums and gliders were doing in this amazing forest. And then we needed to know what the effect of fire and logging was on the habitat of the animal. Then we needed to know why the forest worked the way it did. Then we needed to know how animals worked into how the forest worked. And it's simply gone on from there. And so
this is from my biology textbooks of web of life, is it? Is this a?
It's truly a web of life. So we've threaded together many different strands. It's been many PhD programs, including my own, and it's really developed into probably one of the best known forest ecosystems in Australia, if not the world, from that body of work. And so we understand that in terms of fire, in terms of logging, in terms of how the climate's changing, and it is changing in that forest and quite quickly, how the animals respond to that, many aspects of how the forest works or used to work relative to what's happening now.
Mm. Professor David Lindemeyer, I put it to you before that, of course, many Australians have got emotionally quite connected and affected by the plight of the orangutan. You make a comparison with that, with our own, say, the Leadbeater's possum.
Absolutely. What we learned very quickly in the early 1990s was that Leadbeater's possum was really a symbol of our ability to do ecologically sustainable forest management or not. And the thing about Leadbeater's possum is that it's an endangered species, possibly soon to be elevated to critically endangered. And the reality is that there's actually far fewer Leadbeater's possums than there are orangutans. And most Australians wouldn't be aware of that. The difference is that we probably know far more about Leadbeater's possum than we do about orangutans. And we know certainly a lot more about the forest, the mountain ash forest, than we know about the tropical forests in which the orangutans live. And I think that really underscores a really important point, is that we know what we have to do to conserve Leadbeater's possum and to manage those forests. And the problem is that
you say we know, but you're talking about scientists. Does the rest of us know? I mean, we know a lot. We've learnt about the orangutan through various campaigns. Has that won the day?
There's no doubt that things have changed in Borneo and those areas. Mind you, there's still enormous pressure in those forests. One of my students has worked on oil palm plantation conversion, and that's still going on at a pretty rapid rate in that part of the world. Yes, it's true that we, as a group of scientists, know what is involved there. But it's also true that state government agencies and conservation groups and increasingly politicians in Victoria know what needs to happen. It's just that that knowledge hasn't connected with the reality of what's needed on the ground.
Because I didn't know you could put two Leadbeater's possum into a margarine tub. No, but I've got a good idea of what an orangutan looks like.
That's true. And I think one of the sad things in Australia is that the vast majority of Australians are actually quite disconnected from from the wildlife in their own country. So, of course, people know about kangaroos and koalas and wombats, but that's just such a tiny fraction of the extraordinary wildlife that's here. And I can give you a classic example, Alex. We work on an animal called the mountain brush-tailed possum.
You're listening to Conversations with Alex Sloane on ABC Radio.
Lovely Richard Feidler there. Alex Sloane with you, and Richard back with you on Friday. My guest on Conversations today is Professor David Lindemeyer, a renowned ecologist. And David, we were getting up to, I just cut you short there on the brush-tailed possum. Tell me the story.
Oh, most people would be aware of the common brush-tailed possum that terrorises vegetable gardens and lives in people's roofs, but it has a cousin called the mountain brush-tailed possum that lives in wet forest. And when we first began working on that animal, my wife was funded by the New Zealand Department of Agriculture to find a parasite that would help the New Zealanders control the 70 million common brush-tailed possums that are in New Zealand but shouldn't be there. So we trapped animals, we collected parasites from all these animals and measured them. And a couple of years later, our statistician, Ross Cunningham, wanted to do a study to look at the morphology, how these animals were shaped. And we thought it was going to be like koalas, where koalas are small in Queensland and they get big and much larger in Victoria. It's called a cline. So the closer you get to the poles, the bigger these possums should get. And lo and behold, what happened was that didn't turn out at all. What we had was a constellation of possums very similar in body shape in Queensland and New South Wales. And in northern Victoria and central Victoria, we had a much different group of animals. Turns out, it's two different species. Just amazing. So the southern mountain brush-tailed possum lives an hour and a half from the MCG. So this amazing discovery of this new animal, this is only about 7 or 8 years ago. And so it just illustrates the incredible biodiversity of this country. And it happens with all sorts of groups. We know, for example, there are 25 new species of reptiles added to Australia's collection every year. And these are not just little skinky things that people might...
25 new...
New species of reptiles. So there's sometimes these are large snakes, like new species of taipan, new species of king brown snake, those kinds of things. So it's just a remarkable country still to think about the nation's biodiversity.
Just on that, and to... You mentioned your wife, because this is an incredible partnership. Can we talk about the wonderful Karen Vigors, vet, PhD, writer, novelist these days?
Yes, Alex. In the early 1990s, I was working in Victoria and we had a Leadbeater's possum in a veterinary surgery being sedated so that we could put a radio collar on it because we were doing some radio tracking work. And there's this absolutely gorgeous woman who was the vet on the other side of the surgery. And that was... later became my first PhD student and then my wife. But before it sounds too scandalous, we're of similar ages and have similar interests. And we've worked together in many, many things over the last 20, 25 years. And she did her PhD on the mountain brush-tailed possum, trying to find a solution to the common brush-tailed problem in New Zealand. And then she did a postdoctoral study on kangaroos. And... then she became an author and she's up to her third novel. And, you know, the frustrating thing is that she's sold more books with two and a bit novels than I've sold with 36 books myself. So her batting average is much higher than mine.
But it's really interesting because her vet work and her work on animals informs her writing, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. Her interest in landscapes, which we share, her interest in wildlife, her interest in people, young people and older people as well. That really permeates all of her wonderful storytelling. And of course, we talk about characters and novels and books, all sorts of things all the time, which is actually really a lot of fun.
Now, I talked about languages and you have learnt many, many bird calls because you use this to count, do formal counts. Explain that for us.
Okay, so... even though we're probably best known for our work on marsupials, we actually do even more work on the country's bird fauna. So even though it's called bird watching, actually, Alex, it's really bird listening. And all of our studies are done by sound. So we go to our long-term permanent sites, and in the spring each year at those sites, we stand and we listen and we count all the individual species that are calling and try to estimate the abundance of those same species. So it's all done by hearing. And
how do you learn to do that?
That's a good question. First of all, it helps to have my amazing mother, who's got an incredibly attuned musical ear. And then my father's a bird nut and is also interested in music, so perhaps I've inherited that. But essentially what happens is that you start with the common birds, and it's just practice. It's like anything else, like any language. You go out and you listen and you look and you can recognize that that's a Crimson Rosella or a King Parrot or what have you, and you learn those and then you add new ones.
How do you estimate numbers from?
It's worked out by distance. So we estimate the distance to where we think the bird is calling from. And in generally, when we do the statistical analysis, we convert it back to just presence or absence of a particular species. And we do that repeatedly at a number of points. And then on another day, a different observer comes and counts in exactly the same way, but it's on a different day. And that way we build up a really good picture of what's on many, many sites.
Because I've spoken to Richard Kingsford before about aerial surveys from planes.
Yes.
Well.
Yeah, that works really well for water birds. Not so good for things that are under the canopy or in the canopy or in the shrub layer. And that's most of our birds in woodlands or forests or down at the coast in heathlands.
Well, let me play you a few of your friends.
Okay, is this a test out?
No, look, it's just, let's listen.
I'd say that's a white-winged triller.
You would be dead right. Let me play this one.
Oh, no. Western warbler or white-throated warbler.
Western Gerigon?
Jirigini.
Jirigini.
Yeah.
Jirigini.
That's
I could identify the blowfly in that.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yes. So if I heard that in Western Australia, you'd hear a little sort of pop goes the weasel right at the end.
I probably cut the... I'll just play this one for you.
Yeah. Oh, that's a tough one. I'd say it has to be a flycatcher.
A painted honey eater.
A painted honey eater. Georgie, so it is.
Now, this is Ian Fraser, a renowned birdo, has sent me through. He said, this one will trick him.
Yeah,
I'll
right.
just play this one.
Oh, I'll have to hear it again, Alex. All That's right. a shocker.
he said, this one's a hard one.
Oh,
hooded robin.
A hooded robin, yes, of course.
He said it was going to be a hard one.
Yeah, because they don't call very often, and you're more likely to see it than hear it. But, yeah, that's okay. I haven't seen one for a while, so that's... Oh, I've only got 2 out of 4.
You're doing very much... Well, I can only pick the blowfly. Professor David Lindemeyer, my guest, Professor of Ecology and Conservation Biology. If I can go back to that long, long study you've done on the mountain ash forest, because that is around the town of Marysville. David, and I can remember seeing you at the time of the 2009 devastating bushfires, and if I've ever seen you put your head down, it was at that time. It was a very emotional, hard time, wasn't it? You knew a lot of people.
I knew a lot of people. I had lived in Marysville for extensive spells right through from 1983. In fact, we had a field camp planned for 2 weeks after the 2009 fires with Earthwatch volunteers. And so we stayed at a place called Nandabinya Lodge, just on the edge of Marysville. And that lodge was completely destroyed in the 2009 fires. And the owners of the lodge died. We also lost friends in other parts, particularly Steeles Creek. And my wife's parents were burnt out. Their house wasn't burnt down, but they lost all their stock, all their fences, all their sheds. So it was an enormous event, a huge event. Obviously, people were far greater, more affected than what we were. But my wife left early the next morning and went straight to Healesville to start helping her parents. And it was a very difficult time. And I remember fielding two telephone calls in the middle of the night, one from a close colleague in Seattle and another one, a close colleague in New Hampshire. And they had both reviewed our work previously. And both of them said, you need to do the science of how this forest system recovers. You need to sit down and you need to think about what's going to happen. And in many respects, it's led to enormous management learning and ecological learning as a consequence of that fire. So we've continued to work in the 5 years since the fire to collect data on the birds and on the forest, on the possums, the small mammals, the invertebrates, and the fire itself to understand what's going on. So it's been quite a journey, quite a shocking journey in some ways, but also an incredible learning journey at the same time. And I suppose that's really where it's at. I think when you stop learning, it's really time to give it away.
Because, and I know Professor of History at the ANU, Tom Griffiths, his wonderful essay, We Still Have Not Lived Long Enough Yet, which referenced the Royal Commission after the fires in the 1940s. So your work is really going to that in terms of what we know and what we understand, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So some of the things that we've learned are that the bird fauna, for example, is responding very quickly. The mammal fauna is not, particularly the possums and gliders. But I think probably most controversially, we also understand that the way forests have been logged in the last 30 or 40 years has made them more likely to burn at much higher severity than otherwise would have been the case. Now, I know that that's not necessarily what some people want to hear, but that's actually what the scientific evidence shows. And we have a couple of scientific papers that will be published hopefully in the next month or so, which show that quite clearly, that what we've been doing in that forest in the last 30 or 40 years has made it more fire prone.
Because I noticed some essays or articles you published on The Conversation, and then I looked to the comments underneath, and there will be comments from people accusing you of activism. Tell me about accusations like that.
That's been the case for 30 years, Alex. Leadbeater's possum is an animal that seems to be associated with controversy always. As I said previously, it's a symbol of ecologically sustainable forest management. So our ability to ensure that species doesn't go extinct is really a test of whether or not we can manage the forest in a sustainable way.
So you're saying it's like a canary?
It's really an indicator of sustainability. And what we've seen in the last 5 years from examining the forest more closely is that Leadbeater's possum is in very steep decline. The habitat that it requires, particularly the very large old trees, that's in very steep decline. We know that the amount of old forest is now below 1.16%, and it should be somewhere between 30 to 60% of that forest. So the forest itself is very close to ecological collapse, as has been defined by others. So really there's some significant problems in this system, and Leadbeater's possum is emblematic of the kinds of deep-seated issues that are taking place there. And I know that many people understand what's happening now, but some people are very much wanting to keep things as they've been for the last 40 or 50 years, but we know that that can't keep happening.
With expertise and studies comes passion. And does that, when you get these accusations of activism, how do you split the two? Because you are passionate.
Absolutely. I love doing science. I love doing environmental science and conservation science and ecology. I'm very passionate about making sure that our science is at the best quality, the highest quality possible. And we go through this incredibly rigorous process to get the data, and then to go through the peer review process, which is incredibly bruising, and then to publish the material. But very few people read that science, so we have to get that science out to the broader public. And so we do publish popular books and other materials to get that message out there. And really it's around, how do we manage this public resource in the best possible way so that the public gets the best value, the best return on that investment? And the science is showing that what we're presently doing in that forest through industrial clear felling is not giving the taxpayer the best return on its investment, on its public resource?
Because we are, and we're never too far in the political debate about forests, but it's quite front and centre at the moment. We heard, of course, the Prime Minister before the Tasmanian elections to talk about, I think we've gone too far and that we're locked out of the forests. And then we've seen the result in Tasmania and talk about revisiting the forest agreement there. What's your perspective on this? Some people go, democracy has spoken.
Yes, that's true. Democracy has spoken. And that's a fantastic thing about living in this country and, for example, not being in Crimea. But I look at it from what the science is telling us. And I also increasingly look at it in terms of the different kinds of values of that system. So we know through a book that we wrote late last year that the value of the water for the city of Melbourne, soon to be Australia's largest city, the value of the water far exceeds the value of the forest for paper. So make no mistake, 83% by volume of everything cut in this forest is for paper. It's not for timber. It's for paper. And so,
because it's just on that, there is an emotional, I think, attachment for fine craftsmanship and the use of timber.
Absolutely. And my own house is full of timber products. But this forest is cut primarily for paper. And when we do the breakdown, what we see is that only 4% of the total biomass in the forest actually goes into products that are stored long-term as furniture, as framing for mirrors, those kinds of things. 83% goes into paper products. And then of the rest of the timber, it's mostly industrial timber, Alex. It's mostly things to do, for example, for carting beer pallets for carting beer. Well-known industrial beers on industrial wood. And I know that that's also controversial, but that's actually the breakdown of what goes on. And we see that the value of these forests for water, for biodiversity, for carbon storage, these are the most carbon-dense forests in the world, and we've worked on that as well, and increasingly for tourism, those values far exceed the value of these forests for paper.
Because you did congratulate the Prime Minister for saying we're open for business.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's really important that Australia's open for business, but they need to be sensible businesses, Alex. Businesses where if we invest in them, they bring back a strong return to the investor, the Australian taxpayer. So I understand that we're no longer going to make Commodores or Camrys or slice up peaches and put them in tins. I understand that. And I also understand that this is the end of the age of entitlement. I understand that quite well. But I don't understand why the entitlement is there to cut these forests in this way, which actually degrades these other values and actually delivers not a profit, but actually a significant loss to the investor, to the Victorian and Australian taxpayers. For me, that doesn't work when we know that these other values are significantly more.
Then why does it resonate so much with that statement, we've been locked out of the forest, you know, we have a right to have access to those and a right to regional jobs?
I think there's several things, Alex. One is that I would suggest that most people are unaware, for example, the value of these kinds of forest resources for tourism. So we know, for example, the Victorian Premier's own website shows that tourism in Victoria brings in $10.9 billion a year and 13.7% by gross regional product, it's about $1.7 billion, comes from tourism in the Yarra Valley area where the Central Highlands forests are located. We know in Tasmania, for example, that there are 15,000 jobs in tourism, but only 1,238 in forestry, yet the forest industry will receive $100 million in subsidies over the next 4 years. So there's a big mismatch. Tourism and the tourist industry is a huge provider of jobs. It's a service industry. And in places like the Central Highlands of Victoria, it could grow massively. And if it's managed in the right way, employ many people without degrading the forest resource, which is the key for what people want to come and see. We know that. The data's there to show that.
You're actually proposing a new national park, aren't you?
We are. We're proposing the Great Forest National Park, not only for biodiversity conservation, but also for water production, for carbon storage, because these forests are really important for that, but also for tourism, to bring people to these regional areas. And these regional areas need rejuvenation after the fires. And there are some quite straightforward ways that don't cost a lot of money to create regional infrastructure around tourism to bring people. So if we look at tourism in Victoria,
Because this park would be, it's right on the doorstep of Melbourne.
That's right. It's about an hour and a half from the middle of Melbourne. And we know that there's over 14 million domestic visitors to Melbourne every year, and 1.4 million international visitors. So just to have those people, a small proportion of those people for one or two extra days in that region would make an enormous change to the economic fabric of that area. So that's a real win for tourism, for jobs, for the economy, and for the environment, and for the people of Melbourne. It's so clear what needs to happen.
And if we think about tourism, we think about Australians going to walk in New Zealand or even walk in Southeast Asia to see the orangutans. And what would I see if I walk?
So if you go for a walk in this country, 1.5 hours from the MCG, you can see some of the tallest flowering plants on the planet. You can walk in some of the most extraordinary forests anywhere in the world. You can walk for half a day, for 2 days, 3 days, and that's one of the things that needs to happen. We need to put in the walking infrastructure like the New Zealanders have done, and I've just been there myself with my kids just a few months ago. It doesn't take a lot to put that infrastructure in. It doesn't cost a lot. We've seen the Tahoon walkway in southern Tasmania absolutely revolutionise and rejuvenate the economy of that local area around Jeeveston. It's very straightforward to do that. That costs $2.6 million, Alex. It's not a lot of money in the scheme of things. It's a tiny fraction of the subsidies that the forest industry receives in that part of Victoria. And it's a huge way forward, open for business for this century, not last century. That's my psyche on this.
I noticed, I think it came through Twitter on the weekend, a conversation going on in the US about science communication and a poll taken on how many Americans know a scientist. And it came in at 18%, and most cited a medical doctor. What do you think the result would be here?
I think it would be probably similar. I would imagine that people like Norman Swan on our own ABC would probably be much better known than the vast majority of any other kinds of scientists. And it's true that most people are interested in medicine and their own health, and that's a good thing. But, certainly a lot of the rest of us have probably been missing in action in terms of advocating the case for sustainable development, for environmental-based tourism, and for thinking deeply about the nation's resources and how to use them sustainably, not for next year, not for next decade, but for many decades ahead.
Because I wonder about how many little kids, and you were probably one of them, influenced by David Attenborough.
Oh, massively so. Massively so. And what we really need is somebody articulating the science more deeply about how the science is done, how that fits with how you balance resource use, and how you balance that science for trading off different things, whether it be tourism, carbon, water, those kinds of things, which are really important to the future of this country.
Do you think we're interested in watching that sort of stuff on our TVs in Australia?
Well, I think of extraordinary people like Carl Sagan in the past, who brought the cosmos to our living rooms. And I think there is a passion for that kind of science, to explain to people, how do we know certain things about why animals live where they do, how disturbance changes those things and how they recover after disturbance, how we discover new species, how we discover all kinds of amazing things that are there to be understood about this amazing country that we live in.
David Lindemeyer, I cited all the 36 books, 490 peer-reviewed papers, and I told you about Professor David Goodall, who's turning 100, so you've got a little bit of work ahead of you. But would you advise your children to go into the area that you've gone into? What kind of difference do you think you've made?
Oh, I can't judge whether I've made a difference or not, Alex. Really, the main thing for me is to be able to make a contribution as best I can. What I would advise my children is to go where their passions are, and to work with their passions, because if you are passionate about something, that means that you work hard at it and you'll end up almost all the time being good at it, and being able to make a contribution to society, to Australia, and to the world. That, to me, that's really important, to be able to say that, you know, what have you done with this one precious life? And if you've made a contribution, I think that's a really important motivational thing.
So in the final minute, if you get to be 100, what do you want to look back and say?
I think I'd like to look back, not only my own family, but my students and postdocs over the years have been a kind of a second family, and to have been able to make a contribution to their career developments and their training and their advancement and the advancement of understanding science and society in Australia, I think is really important to be able to do.
Do you think you'll look back and see a Leadbeater's possum?
I really hope so, Alex. I think the way is clear what we need to do. It's just that we need governments and others to grow the spine to do that. And I'll keep pushing for that.
So it's like that Mandela line, when we know what to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We know what to do. We just have to get in there and do it.
David Lindemann, thanks for taking the time today. So appreciate it.
That's an absolute pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.